At least from the central time zone here in the upper Midwest, near America's North Coast, it's already officially Valentine's Day, so happy Valentine's Day. I'll be celebrating my 25th Valentine with my wife in the morning. And by the way, Julie Boyd from the third grade, who took my Valentine that I gave her in class and threw it on the floor and stood on it. Eat your heart out. 25 years, very happy together. And actually, you know, if somebody were to eat your heart out, that somebody might be a guest on Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. We'll talk with Andrew Zimmern coming up tonight. Have you seen Bizarre Foods or his other show, Bizarre World, on the Travel Channel? You know what I'm talking about. Andrew Zimmern is a chef. He is a well-known television personality. He is an expert on food, and not just from the kind that people in sort of mainstream culture eat, but also a culinary expert on the bizarre. And in this case, if there is somebody that's eating the heart of something, chances are even a beating heart of something, Andrew has been there on the other side of the plate. We'll talk about his experiences on the Travel Channel, plus what he has learned about people through the food that they eat. The show Bizarre Foods has been around long enough now that I'm beginning to wonder whether they've run out of bizarre foods to eat. I was watching one from, I don't know, three seasons ago or something when they were replaying it, and I saw something that I rarely saw Andrew Zimmern do, and that is he almost, well, he couldn't finish it. He took one bite and had to spit it out. Most of the times, no matter how disgusting it looks or how much it wiggles as he eats it, Andrew Zimmern is able to choke it down. But we'll talk about what he's learned from that and about us, too, coming up. And then later on in the night, Andrew will be on for a couple hours, and then we'll talk with Gregory Hartley. He's got a very interesting life story, too. He's co-author of The Body Language Handbook, How to Read Everyone's Hidden Thoughts and Intentions. But he has also had a career with the U.S. Army, teaching interrogation and resistance to interrogation. So both sides of the fence. And he has sat in on several of these special forces interrogations during Operation Desert Storm, just to try to read what he could from the body language of the people that they were, well, the people they were talking to, hoping to find out whether or not they were telling the truth. Want to know if somebody's lying to you while they're talking to you? Gregory Hartley can tell you so many hidden tricks coming up later on in the show. But first, Andrew Zimmern next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Andrew Zimmern is a New York City boy who went to Vassar College and then made his way out here to the upper Midwest, where Andrew Zimmern and I worked together for about 15 minutes. Hey, Andrew, how are you tonight?
Hello, my friend. A little longer than 15 minutes. I'll give you 20.
Yeah, about. And it's, you know, it is funny. It's good to hear you. And I, Tommy tells me you got a lot going on. So thank you for giving us your time tonight.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I we've been trying to do this in complete transparency. We've been trying to do this for a while, but schedules are kind of goofy and I'm away 35 weeks a year. So
yes, you are.
It gets a little dicey trying to hook something like this up for a couple hours, but I'm glad we could do it.
Good. Well, thank you. And as a star of the Travel Channel, no surprise that you're traveling 35 weeks a year, but I know that when you get home, and I could probably meet you outside in about 2 minutes if we started driving toward each other's houses right here.
Yes.
We could probably do that. And I know that when you get home, you value your time a lot. So I'm grateful you were able to give us some of that tonight.
My pleasure.
All right. So I also, you know, I probably know more about your story that's in your wiki entry. So what I don't know. I'm got a little trepidatious about what to say about your life, but I think
it's all public.
So explain maybe how you got from New York out of nowhere into Minnesota and then from there to the rest of the world.
Oh, sure. You know, you mentioned the Travel Channel, the Vassar College connections. You know, I'm born and raised in New York City, went to, you know, always involved in the food business. I begged my parents to let me work in restaurants when I was, 12, 13, 14. I thought the other kids in the summer community that we spend time in were nuts to be working at the landscape place, sweating away, raking someone's lawn all day long, and then collapsing at home at night. I wanted to be on the beach all day long and then in restaurants at night. I thought restaurants were fascinating. I loved food. I always had been an adventurous eater and came from a family that traveled and ate, when in Rome style. We didn't eat, hamburgers at the Hard Rock Cafe in Beijing. If we were lucky enough to be somewhere exotic, we ate what we found on the ground. And so I had a fairly well-formed food life, started working one night a week in restaurants when I was 14 years old and all the way through high school, and then went to college. And, I wanted to get in the food business right away, but my parents decided that they put a lot of pressure on me, and I'm glad they did, to learn how to read, write, and think critically.
Yeah.
And, I ended up at Vassar College, close enough to New York City to maintain a lot of ties, tried cooking school for about 6 minutes back in fall of 79. That did not end well. I walked into a room and there were 70-year-old German guys teaching food from a blackboard. And this was before the, 2-year waiting list and $45,000 a year tuition that they have at cooking schools these days. And it was, I ran away to Europe and started cooking and came back and got a degree in history and a degree in art history from Vassar and spilled out of there, and into the restaurant world in New York City, and, was talented enough to land a head chef's job at an extremely way too young an age. And, with my love for, chemicals and partying and the sexy allure.
I was waiting for that part.
New York City in 1984, when I sort of, really started, got my first good job where I could afford an apartment on my own and the sorts of things I wanted to do, was a crazy wild time. Famous people hadn't dropped dead from using coke yet. Drugs were, people, you'd bump into people's parents at Studio 54. And it was a much different time than it was then. I don't want to romanticize it out of proportion, but, that was an amazing place to be spending your, get off work at midnight, 12:30, with a wad of cash in your pocket and go out till 6 in the morning. It was an amazing time and place, but I developed a horrific drug and alcohol problem. So, it just, everything sort of spiraled downwards. And as my star grew in New York, so did my drinking and drugging problem, until finally it sort of overwhelmed everything. And in 1990, I went homeless for about 11 and a half, I mean, truly homeless, like living in squatting buildings with
really?
Casements in the windows, and should have died many, many times. And with, just real tawdry, sad, depressing tale that is unfortunately played out all too many times.
Right.
All across this country. And one day I met a friend. I had agreed to meet a friend for coffee and walked into an intervention and wound up at Hazelden 18 years ago, this last January 28th. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated 18 years of continuous sobriety. And I'm very public about that because I think it's important that people know that someone can go from homeless, street junkie, drunk, to having, being a useful member of society and paying taxes and being a father and being a husband and creating a good life for the people around them and being a contributing member of society. Too often we think of drug addicts and alcoholics as the guy that you see in handcuffs being,
right,
let out of someone's house on the nightly news. And along the way, I, got this crazy TV show.
Well, and it started off as a local show and grew from there. But, the interesting thing about your renaissance here,
yeah,
after you got out of Hazelden, like a lot of people, they come to Hazelden and then they realize, I can't go back to the old playground. I can't go back to the same sandbox, and I better stay in some place where there's other people around me that are also trying to be sober.
I talk to a lot of people about this, and there are some people that have a, they get a DUI, or they're caught drinking at work, or there's a problem with the marriage, and someone says, hey, you got a problem with drugs or alcohol, and they end up going, somewhere, an outpatient thing, or maybe to a 12-step meeting, or you know, maybe they, you know, have some other sort of experience that that gets them into a sober state of mind. They're able to stay that way. They have a bottom, but they don't hit absolute bottom. There are also a group of alcoholics and drug addicts who absolutely have to, you know, go through every one of Dante's, you know, circles of the inferno before it gets their attention. And those are the people that have to be transported halfway across the country, you know, and put into a, you know, a living situation not of their own making for 5 or 6 months. And again, not trying to glorify it, but it's just a fact. You know, some are sicker than others. And I needed all the help I could get. And so a one-way ticket to Minnesota was the best thing that ever happened to me. And, you know, I was always planning on going back to New York and starting over again, or to Los Angeles, where I'd been working for a while. But the bottom line was, I woke up one day, I was like a year sober, and I was, you know, I had a restaurant in Minneapolis with a partner, and we were very successful, and my life was better than it ever had been, and I was happy for the first time in my life. And, you know, I could not don't fix it kind of people, and haven't found an exit for 18. It's been pretty good.
Well, questions on the sobriety. And also on the idea that you were smart enough to, after your intervention, I mean, you were smart enough to realize that that your same old patterns might have the same old result. And there's a lot of people who have to take two or three spins through rehab before they start catching on to that theory. So.
Let me not, you know, I gave you the shorthand version.
Okay.
This was about my umpteenth intervention. I mean, I was umpteenth treatment. I was in psych wards, detoxes, hospitals, police stations. I served time in penal institutions. I mean, I was, you know, I woke up one day after, you know, a traumatic event in college my freshman year, where I had acute alcohol and poisoning and a drug overdose, and was asked to leave college, and a drug counselor there intervened on my behalf and told me that I was chronic on the Jelinek scale at age 18, and I laughed at him, you know, and kept going for another 12 years. So no, the smarts had nothing to do with it. Absolutely dumb, stupid, tawdry fool. However, at the time I got sober, I would have sobered up in a liquor store. I really was sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned about the arrests and penal institutions, whatever, because I don't think I've ever seen the Andrew Zimmern and celebrity mugshot. And you online, like anybody who's ever been arrested, there's their celebrity mugshot.
This is the great thing about, and it's so funny that you say that, because at the point in time, you know, my wife and I adopted our son Noah, and you know, we were scheduled to do an international adoption in a country that doesn't have a lot of the same rules that we have, you know, before Noah came into our lives. And I had to do all of this insane paperwork, and one of the things you had to produce was all your old criminal records.
Uh-oh.
And so I actually had to go back and get all this stuff, and I kid you not, the greatest blessing in my life as a TV personality is that I did all these foolish dumb things way before the digital age, and so everything is on these handwritten sheets, and there's no it's absolutely fantastic. And I also had my very serious arrests all were under the categorization of ACDs, action in contemplation of dismissal. So once I was good for a couple of years in a certain state, all the records were expunged. So it was really one of those sort of gifts from God that has resulted in the lack of those.
But I'm disappointed.
On the internet.
I'm disappointed because I want an Andrew Zimmern and mugshot with hair.
I had hair almost as robust and beautiful as yours, and I weighed about 85 pounds, and my skin was gray. And you know me well enough to know that I'm bald, a little thicker around the middle, and anything but gray and wallow skin.
No,
but it was just so – it was such a crazy time in my life. I'm glad I survived it.
How did you make the jump, though? I mean, you went from local personality to national TV personality pretty fast. And a lot of people, when they do that, that's often when they have those, you know, oh, I'm a big shot star.
Sure,
you know, everybody buy me a drink at the bar. I mean, it's good that you didn't relapse then. I mean,
well, you know, it's interesting. I when the TV thing hit, I was, well, I mean, I would do the chronology. I was in restaurants here for about 8 or 9 years and then started working. I decided that I visioned the food media world a year before it exploded. And I said, I got to get involved in this. And if I'm going to make a jump into something other than restaurants, I got to do it now. And so I got in, I went to a radio station, a TV station, a magazine, and said, you know, basically I'll work for free. Let me do anything. And it kind of started here, and I did it all local and then statewide and then regionally and then nationally. And now my television program airs in 70 countries. So I guess technically I'm international.
You are
but
international.
That all happened over the last, you know, 7 years. And I'm really glad that I had, you know, 10, 11 years of sobriety under my belt before that stuff hit, because it's bad even now. I mean, your mind plays some goofy tricks on you. And you know as well as I do, because you have, you know, tons of fans, and people will say to you things that, you know, that they'll walk up to you at an event or something and say, oh, Ian, I listen to you all the time. You're fantastic. I love you. And it may be on a day that you feel less than lovable. You know, you just did something really stupid with the kids or with the wife or with a friend or, gave someone short shrift in the office hallway. And it can be very, very,
intoxicating.
And it is, and it is intoxicating.
It is intoxicating.
But I think what's interesting is that once the Travel Channel show hit, I was also lucky enough to open my mouth at the right meetings to have included in my show certain aspects of human culture that I really was interested in, that actually sort of keep me grounded both at home and while I'm at work. You know, the family meals that we have in our show, the exploration of the different spiritual systems, you know, that everybody gets confused about, but I just think it's so fascinating. I can't stay away from it, and I try to combine, you know, food with the idea of, you know, what's bigger than us, anywhere that I can. And those kind of things, I don't know. I also have a wife that, you know, doesn't take me as seriously as I take myself. And that's probably a good thing too.
I think it is. Well, back to then bizarre foods and the things that you eat. What I love about the show and what I love about how you do it is it could be a total freak show. It could be you go in and you're like, look at these weirdos, look what they're eating.
Sure.
And that you establish the plumb line as being this sort of, and I say this with a in quotes, but a certain amount of jingoism that you could bring to that show that says, you know, I'm going to be sort of ethnocentric about how I view what you do as being less than what we do. And you don't. I mean, I think you come in and you show as much respect as can possibly be shown to somebody who's eating a live slug, and you do the things that I don't think the rest of us could do. I think 99% of the viewers probably couldn't eat what you eat,
but you do it
in a way that opens the door for feeling like you're making a connection to that person and not mocking them.
But you've hit the nail on the head, and very few people actually see that for what it is, and I'm not trying to blow smoke somewhere, Ian, but you could do it. You have, because I remember when we worked together, no, seriously, you have an ability to talk to people with a certain amount of respect and honoring where they're coming from. And I paid attention when I was sort of coming up the media ladder here. It was really easy to poke fun at someone, and I'd be one and done in terms of years on air. If you respect people and you engage them, there's a later on life. And I really, really believe that it's how you treat people that's the secret of your success. And I think it's the secret to the longevity of the show.
Well, I'll go along with that, but I will tell you, when I saw the line it finally took for you to spit out something into a napkin on an episode, I know my line would have been long before then. So we'll get back to that. The bizarre foods that Andrew Zimmern has eaten, what he's learned about people along the way. And we'll talk about some of the things which people do eat and how it reflects on both their history, but also what their future is as a people. Are bizarre foods disappearing as the world becomes sort of more globally connected? We'll talk about that. We'll take your calls, too. You'll get more with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods and Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre World coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern is in its fifth season or sixth season. I can't remember. We'll find out coming up in just a second. We'll also find out how long it'll be till they run out of bizarre foods to eat. And some of the things that Andrew Zimmern has eaten over the years that I made note of to talk about with him and to wonder about with him coming up in just a second. We'll also take some calls from you next hour. If you go to coasttocoastam.com and find out more about the After Dark newsletter, you can sign up. You can also find out, too, about the top stories of the day, which I didn't mention because we just jumped right into the show tonight. And I put a blog up that had a very cool photo. I was involved in the consecration of a bishop today. I didn't take the photo, and I wasn't in any way actually there during the important parts of the service. But it is a cool photo, and you can go take a look online. As cool a photo as you can possibly take of the consecration of a bishop. You can see it at coasttocoastam.com. We put up the link to my blog there. And then it tells the story, too, of the Wolfman. I know last night George Norrie had on a folklore expert talking about the history of Wolfman stories, kind of werewolf folklore in general. This weekend, Benicio del Toro's remake of The Wolfman is out, and it's getting, you know, terrible reviews. Haven't seen it. Don't know if I'll bother, but I've always been fascinated with The Wolfman. He's my favorite of the Universal monsters, and the Wolfman stories are really a metaphor for how the screenwriter of the original 1941 production, how he felt when he was living in Nazi Germany. He was a Jewish screenwriter when his country turned against him and began to hunt him down. And he was wearing a Star of David sewn onto his coat. And that was the beginning of the pentagram on the hand of the Wolfman, and how the Wolfman is being hunted and being controlled by evil forces outside, really, of his desire. He's not an intentional Wolfman. He's not one that's enjoying the status like other, you know, representations of that story. He is truly a victim, and the world is closing in on him, much like the way the screenwriter felt in Nazi Germany. And that's the basis of the Wolfman. If you want to read more about that, you can read it on the blog right there at coasttocoastam.com. And there's a couple of links from there onto some other things. So take a look and come by here in just a few minutes. And Andrew Zimmern will explain the things that he's eaten that were still alive when he ate them. And what did that, how did that ever change him? How do you eat things that you've never thought were even considered to be, if you pardon the term under this case, or maybe literally kosher? And how do you do that and not be changed by it? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. And if that rejoinder music sounds a little bit like a beating heart, it wouldn't be the first time that Andrew Zimmern has eaten something with a beating heart. That was in your pilot episode. Didn't you eat frog heart on Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern the very first time out of the box?
Yeah. Oh, it was. Not only was it the very first time out of the box, it was the very first day of shooting. At 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, someone slid a beating frog heart in front of my nose. It was the very first thing I ever had to shoot for the Travel Channel, and oh my gosh, it sort of defined what we were going to do. Yeah, it was, and it's interesting because, you know, before we went to break, we were talking about treating people with respect. And I, you know, at that very moment, I guess I was confronted with the choice of whether I was going to make fun of the people, right, that I was on camera with, which I, you know, I don't know. It, looking back on it, I make it sound like it was a decision. It was really never a decision. It never occurred to me. I'm so fascinated by how other people eat and the traditions that they have and what makes for, you know, cuisine culture and how it's influenced and how it influences, you know, what we do and how we think. And I really do think that food is, you know, both symptomatic and causal. I'm just fascinated by this. And I was just, you know, I was so amazed, and all I had were questions and smiles. And, you know, frequently these foods are being made by somebody's grandmother who's, you know, spent days or, you know, in most cases when we do a lot of Aboriginal or tribal stories or traditional family meals, we're with people who, you know, hack open a, you know, some animal, some, you know, livestock, and it might represent 25, 30, 40, 50% of the family's net worth, and they put it on a plate and slide it in front of me. Yeah. And at that point, how would you do anything other than be extremely grateful and want to find out how it is that they have come to eat what they're eating?
Well, but if you'll pardon the expression, I mean, when you're eating essentially a still living frog,
mm-hmm.
That is what some people refer to as a real kind of, you know, come to Jesus moment right there. You either you decide what you're going to be, you decide what you're going to do, right? It's a here I stand moment. Do I eat it, or do I say this TV thing looked really good right up until right now?
See, but I never even had to think about it.
That's amazing.
Why wouldn't you eat it? I mean, to me, I'm so bored with, I mean, maybe it's like a painter looking for new colors or a musician looking for, you know, a combination of notes. Maybe it's how, you know, some of the more, you know, esoteric John Cage or Brian Eno sorts of things get written because they're bored with the way notes, you know, conventionally show up on song sheets. I'm just, you know, boneless, skinless chicken breast frozen from a supermarket shelf. I mean, you know, how many ways can you pan fry it? I mean, you know, yeah, 365, you know, the people make gimmicky books out of it. But I just don't want to experience that. When that guy held up the bag of frogs at the Asadachi restaurant in Tokyo, this teeny little Getemono restaurant where men go to eat for sport, to seal a deal or to challenge each other, and he holds up the bag of frogs, and I picked one, and he made a little incision around its neck, and he strips its skin off, and in about 15 seconds has all the meat served to me sashimi style, the bone simmering in a little porridge with some rice and dashi, and the beating heart, you know, on a little tray in front of me. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like a raindrop entering the river. It was amazing. I loved it.
Yeah. But tell me that doesn't change you. I mean, when you're doing something like, and it may be not just any one individual food, but somewhere along the line, you realize that you have entered into rare air. You are probably if not the only person on the planet, maybe only five other people in the club in which you find yourself that has eaten all of the world's most bizarre foods.
Yeah, there's very few of us, and there's only a couple that actually, you know, live their brand, so to speak. And, you know, I'm not trying to get all media crazy, but there's lots of people on other networks other than ours that when the cameras stop rolling, they stop doing what it is they do on air. I don't. My camera crew has to pull me out of the little huts in Botswana where we're eating, you know, raw African porcupine. I mean, I'm you know, that's what I want to be doing. And the head of the anthropology department, Graduate School of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota, said to me 2 years ago, he referred to me as a colleague, and I laughed at him. He said to me, he says he has tenured professor friends at other, you know, major state universities, you know, leading anthropological departments that haven't been to as many places and eaten with as many traditional tribes as I have. And I was stunned when he told me that. I'm an extremely, extremely lucky person. And to be able to, you know, bury eels in grated fresh coconut wrapped in, you know, giant banana leaves and a Samoan atoll, you know, or to, you know, hunt fruit bats in Cambodia, you know, with people who have, you know, had managed to, you know, keep their lives intact, you know, with the Khmer Rouge issues, et cetera. I mean, you know, these are moments that I would treasure forever. The day that the week I spent with the tribe in Botswana may be the single greatest week of my life professionally.
Let me run down I want to run down a couple of things and just give me quick, you know, thumbnail impressions of was it good? Did it taste good? Not whether you could eat it. But sure. Quick little things. Yeah. Frog sashimi. You ended up liking it?
Fantastic. The tinny, sort of metallic, thin flavor of reptile is ideally suited to eat sashimi style with a little bit of soy and wasabi. It was fantastic.
Frog ovary soup.
Very benign. You really don't know what you're eating. I wouldn't call it a gimmick food, but it's one of those things that's eaten in traditional Chinese medicine and it's, other corollaries in other Southeast Asian countries as medicine. It's not intended to be good food. It's intended to be provocative.
Bat.
Much better than I thought it would be. giant 10-pound, and remember, a conventional supermarket chicken is 2.5 to 3 pounds, Ian.
Right, yeah.
A 10-pound giant fruit bat that has done nothing but live on a teeny island in Samoa eating only breadfruit its whole life. It's such a clean animal that when they hunt them and eat them, you can eat the intestines raw. That's how clean the animal is. Very good barbecued with fresh wild ginger juice over a coconut husk fire.
Okay, so free-range bat. Then none of these farm-raised bats that the rest of us have.
That'd be terrible.
Okay, and then soup number five.
Oh my gosh! In Agnonio Province in the Philippines, about 2 hours outside of Manila, they have a restaurant there that's popular for what's called Soup Number Five, which everyone in the Philippines knows what you're talking about, and it's basically the butt and the balls of several different animals all simmered in a putrefied poultry broth. It's very sludgy and slimy, but you can taste the country's struggle and history in that dish.
And did the country struggle taste good?
It tasted interesting to me. and this is what's fascinating, because you talk to people there, and you know, my immediate question after eating it was, why would someone eat this? And then the grandma who made it for me in the restaurant began to describe the condition of the people when this, you know, and her starving artist husband who made this for his friends, and it was what they could eat for free. Basically,
right.
Back then, what they pulled out of the garbage can. And,
sure.
It's an amazing, amazing story. You know, I had the privilege of eating with a 94-year-old woman in Mississippi. She was making raccoon and possum. And it did not taste very good. It tasted gamey and a little overripe, a little barnyardy, a little woodsy. Like it had, these animals pick over a lot of dead feral things in the forest. And
right.
She held my hand and began to tell me about the slaves coming from out of the slave house in the middle of the night, and they could only hunt and kill animals that froze in the lantern light. And she began to describe to me the tradition of pulling the vegetable greens and other things out of the garbage from the big house. And it was food that was familiar to them coming from Africa. And you begin to get to know the people and hear the stories, and you begin to understand how food moves around the world. It moves you in an incredible way. And I thirst for that high again of meeting these people and tasting these foods. So while, you know, roasted raccoon in Mississippi may not be everybody's cup of tea, it's the sum totality of the moment. I would hasten to say that you and your wife's favorite restaurant is your favorite, not just for the food, but for the ambiance or the way they know you or the table or that your friends are always there. Some other sort of aspects of the experience that make it whole for you. And it's the same thing for me with these foods. Sure, on its own, some, you know, Samoan bat. Well, you know, good, right. Not good. But I think that the questions that need to be asked are much bigger than that. You know, why do they eat it? Where do they eat it? How do they hunt it? Who are you eating it with? It, you know, with the moon coming up over the, you know, over the, you know, Pacific, you know, islands there on the night that I ate that bat. There's nowhere I'd rather be in the world than right there at that moment.
Was there any place you would have rather have been when you were eating fermented fish heads in Alaska?
Yes, anywhere.
Yes.
There's a handful of foods that, you know, I mean, although I will say, you know, I'd spent the whole day riding around on a snow machine being ridden around by a 75-year-old grandma who ended up taking me to her friend's house where those stink heads, by the way, are rolled in hay that's matted with animal urine, and it's buried in the ground. And then when it's putrefied, they dig it up and they slice it and eat it. A horrific food, but you have to understand that up there, you know, the permafrost lasts all year long. You're above the meltout line. And this is the food of subsistence and necessity, and we don't eat that way here in this country.
No.
And all you have to do is experience that couple thousand times like I have to really get turned on by the experience. You get very grateful. It changes. You're right. It does change your life. But I think it's important that we see that. I think it's important that our kids know that that's the way people eat, and that's the way people ate here in the place that you and I live in, Minnesota.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the way they ate 100 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure when fermented fish heads was on the menu here. I mean, I think that is sort of a distinctly Alaskan kind of thing. And I'm taking nothing away from it, although it just looked so gross. But that
was horrific.
Even...
But you should talk, I mean, and you know, I don't want to, you know, get a pissing contest with you. But, you know, talk to a lot of the Native American tribes here. Go up and talk to my friends up on the White Earth Reservation and talk to them about some of the foods that are traditional to their culture and some of the other Native American tribes that are here. And they will tell you that maybe not 100 years ago, but maybe 125.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fair enough. But that was the one when Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern went to Alaska and you ate the
show.
Fermented fish heads and the jellied moose nose.
Oh,
that was the jellied moose nose. When people ask me about the show or I'm trying to explain it, that's the one. That's the iconic dish that I talk about. Jellied moose nose. Explain that.
It's so funny that you pulled that out. I do too. I think that's just an incredible, incredible moment. What they do is, you know, you kill a moose. It's 1,500 pounds. You dress out the hide. You save the bones for tools. You need to do something with the head. And what they do is they boil it, and all the collagen and glycogen is released into this broth, and it becomes very jello-like. And it's got a lot of gelatin in it. And you pull all the meat off. You pull all the get rid of all the hair. You trim away all the little bones and connective tissue. And you pack the tongue, the lips, the nose, which on a moose is very long. Hence the moose nose jelly thing.
Yes.
And you pack it into a pan and you pour the reduced braising liquid on top of it and you put it in the refrigerator or outside.
Wait. Braising liquid just gave that slurry the benefit of the doubt. By calling it a braising liquid, you have elevated it, I believe, in my opinion.
Meat juices.
Okay.
And you put that in the pan and you unmold it, and it's basically the Alaskan version of head cheese.
Oh,
except that moose head tastes doesn't quite have the sex appeal that Tête de Veau has in a Parisian charcuterie shop, but it's basically the same thing, tête de moose. And you know, I Doug Drum up in Girdwood, Alaska. Ugh. I just adore that man. The guy that cooked that for me, Doug Drum, was someone who saw the alcoholism problems in the western villages like Bethel, Alaska, and all the young people moving away because the salmon industry was dying. And he basically took high-end cold smokers out there and taught them how to cure and smoke their own fish and sell it for $40 a pound to specialty food shops in New York and L.A., and is almost single-handedly bringing people back to those little villages economically. It's quite a story. When you
yes.
travel around, you meet these people. It's quite something.
I'd like to meet them without eating their jellied moose nose. Thank you very much. That's what I think. You can meet them. You can hang with them.
Such
you
a great name. Moose nose jelly.
It was so hard to watch. But that, see, now, as much as I know that you are as open-minded as any human being could ever be, times 10, I enjoyed watching you choke on the stinky tofu in Taiwan. I mean, I experienced a certain amount of schadenfreude watching you spit into a napkin going, yes, finally.
It's so confusing for people, too, because the two-day-old tofu that's sold on the streets all over Asia is delicious, and it's kind of like blue cheese. It's you know, spoiled but delicious. The 14-day-old stuff at Dai's House of Unique Stink, the restaurant in Taiwan where I ate the – I mean, she has a organic – decomposed vegetable matter that's 10 years old that she soaks these pieces of tofu in before she cooks them for 14 days. It tastes like a dead body.
Okay, so it's tofu that's been soaked in essentially fermented rotten vegetables. And yep. that slurry of rotten vegetables is 10 years old.
10 years old is like dumpster juice.
Okay, so Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. We will get some calls in coming up next hour. We've got a few more things. I want to find out what Andrew Zimmern has experienced. And I want to find out how close Andrew Zimmern has come to cannibalism. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.